Welcome to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg on a Wednesday.
Hello, everybody. I'm Avi Wolf-Manarin on a Wednesday. And it's a Wednesday with a lot to get to. We're going to talk about the status of a beloved and endangered bird that's making a pit stop in our area right now. We will also discuss a new historical novel with ties to Philly and a remarkable story of survival to tell. And of course, we want your thoughts on yesterday's big primary election.
So call us. The number is 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org. And of course, if you missed all the returns yesterday, no shame, because there were a lot of them. We're going to start today's roundup by taking you through some of the major primary results. So we got a lot to say, and we'll get to analysis later in the hour. But the big one was the race for Philly mayor, the Democratic nomination. Former city council member Sherelle Parker made history after beating eight other Democrats in that primary last night. She is poised to become the first woman and the first black woman mayor of Philadelphia.
She was not able to make a victory speech, unfortunately, because she had a medical issue. But we did get concession speeches from two of the top challengers. This is Helen Gim, followed by Rebecca Reinhart.
Philadelphia has chosen its 100th mayor and elected the first black woman to serve in the highest office in our city.
I want to say that I am really proud of the campaign and the way that all of us here came together to fight for a better Philadelphia.
So we're going to analyze that race in our second segment. There's so much to talk
about
with the Philly mayor's race, but that was not the only race. There were some other really big races in our area. The only, I guess, non-primary yesterday, there was a special election for a state house seat in Delaware County because the member who had it had to resign because of sexual impropriety allegations. And this was very important in part because if Democrats wanted to maintain control of the state house, they needed to win this seat. And it looks like they did. Heather Boyd defeating Katie Ford. Heather Boyd was the Democrat. And there were a lot of dollars on the Democratic side poured into this to make sure Democrats kept control of the PA House. And it looks like it was money well spent, I suppose.
Yeah. A lot of Democrats, they put their bodies on the line. They were phone banking. They did the work and they came out victorious in this case. Also, another race worth mentioning outside of Philly, down in Chester, a mandate vote there. Incumbent Thaddeus Kirtland down 40% to challenger Stefan Roots. Looks like he's going to be, you know, there's going to be a new mayor in Chester. Remember, we did that in the roundup. We talked about how Chester's on the brink of disincorporation. So the voters there have spoken. Also, back to Philly, because so many races happening in Philly and city council at large. Another history maker, Rue Landau, has become the first openly LGBTQ person to win a Democratic nomination to council. So that's a really big deal.
Yeah. And as a reminder, so basically there likely will be five Democrats who win at-large races. We don't have all of the calls yet, but Rue Landau has been called. Two incumbents also holding on to seats in the at-large
Isaiah
race.
Isaiah Thomas and Catherine Gilmore Richardson.
Exactly. And it was a very deep field, so there was the possibility of upsets there. It also looks like Nina Ahmad will likely be one of the Democrats who secures an at-large seat as well. Still some things to be sorted out because we haven't, you know, counted all the votes. And you wanted to talk, Cherry, also about a big district city council race up in Northwest Philadelphia that got a lot of intrigue and
attention. Yeah, District Council 8, the Councilmatic District up there, you know, you had Cindy Bass challenged. She's the incumbent, challenged by Seth Anderson Oberman. Right now, the last I checked, Cindy Bass literally has like a 290 vote lead over her challenger. This is tight. They're going to have to count every single vote. That lead was with 89%. So lots to talk about during our analysis today.
And one of the things that was interesting about it to us, and you moderated a debate up there, is that in geographic councilmanic districts, incumbents usually have a really strong advantage. It's very hard to unseat incumbents in those types of races. We don't know if Anderson Oberman is going to do it, but the mere fact that it's this close is a statement in and of itself.
It's a big statement, and we're going to talk more deeply about that. Can we shout out our reporters last night?
Of course we can, yes.
Who were working, WHYY and Billy Penn reporters. They were all over the place. We also have a live blog, yeah.
Still running right now, whyy.org. You can also head on over to BillyPenn.com. More results, more analysis as those last ballots trickle in.
Yeah, for sure. And I want to, there's another big story in Philly. Caught this morning in West Philly, the second escapee from the Philadelphia Industrial Correctional Center. Amin Hirsch, you remember the second man who escaped jail last week. He was arrested by U.S. Marshals in West Philadelphia in the 6100 block of Washington Avenue. The 18-year-old is accused of committing 4 homicides, Avi, as well as related crimes. And according to the Philadelphia Inquirer, a family member of Hirsch had contacted law enforcement to negotiate a surrender, but Hirsch repeatedly failed to turn himself in on 3 different occasions over the course of 18 hours. So marshals, they set up a surveillance and they had to go and arrest him themselves.
And for those that don't remember this story, don't blame you. There's a lot of politics going on right now. But this story had put a lot of focus on security and staffing in Philly jails. There are a lot of vacant positions.
There's 800, by the way. 800 vacant positions.
800 vacant positions. We still don't really know how these 2 men escaped, but they have now both been apprehended. We know they had help, and other people have now been arrested, and we'll see where those charges go. But again, this was a case that really put a spotlight on some potential glaring issues with the security of Philadelphia's jails and prisons.
Yeah, and now City Council is calling for hearings. They want an investigation. Commissioner Blanche Carney had received a vote of no confidence just days before the escape. So we're probably going to be talking about Philly prisons and jails for a little bit after this.
All right, lots of heavy news today and political intrigue. Let's lighten it up end this segment. Cherry, what do you know about pickleball?
I've heard about it. I heard that people were fighting over some stuff, but I've never played.
You probably have literally heard it because it's a very loud game. Oh. It's sort of like a mix between tennis and ping pong. It's like tennis played in close quarters.
So no pickles are involved.
There's no
Okay. I just wanted to make sure.
I guess you could, while you're having a break from pickleball, go to the sidelines and have a pickle. I don't know. there was an interesting CNN story about the fact that because pickleball is such a fast-growing sport and needs space, some malls are creating indoor pickleball courts, including a mall down the shore in Egg Harbor Township, New Jersey. The space that they're turning into a pickleball court used to be a Burlington Coat Factory store, so it's a big space. And so now it's going to be pickleball space, apparently, and this is happening apparently across the country. It's a trend.
It's a trend. But I gotta say, I mean, this is an innovative use of big box stores, since a lot of people shopping online, not a lot of stores closing down. It also solves that issue of parks and rec facilities, because I'd heard that people were getting in fights over playground space, tennis courts, and all kinds of stuff. You know, I love a good fight, okay, as long as I'm not involved. And so I'd heard about this happening. And so it's nice that, this is a nice compromise and an innovative way to fix a problem.
And to put on my business hat for a second, I do think it's an interesting commentary as well on the future of malls. Because it used to be that we all kind of had to go to the mall to get our stuff. A lot of people, myself included, shop online. And so malls, I think, are trying to reformat and rebrand themselves as destination spaces for activities. Like, have you ever seen, for instance, they'll have these skydiving simulators where you float over a big fan. Obviously, now you can go and play pickleball at the mall. I think it's a sort of the idea that you would go to the mall for an activity and maybe shop on the side as well, because a lot of malls really are struggling.
Yeah, and this will be cool. I have to learn about pickleball, man. I'm a competitive person.
I play tennis. I've never played pickleball, but people rave about it. So, maybe it's great.
Maybe it's great.
We're going to stay down the shore now for our newsmaker interview. The Delaware Bay at the moment is hosting thousands of red knots. These are robin-sized birds that visit our area in the spring and fall as part of a 9,000-mile migration journey that takes them from the tip of South America to the Canadian tundra and back again.
And in recent years, red knot numbers have fallen, and biologists are worried about the species. They are designated as a threatened species federally and endangered by the state of New Jersey. Here to tell us more about these incredible birds and why the Delaware Bay is so critical to their survival is Rutgers ecologist Joanna Berger, who came inside from counting birds in New Jersey to talk with us. How you doing, Joanna? Welcome to studio.
I'm doing fine. Tired, but fine.
Okay, so what are we seeing this year with the red knots? I know we're watching their numbers closely. I get the sense that it's a little early for final conclusions, but what do their numbers look like right now?
Well, at the moment, the birds are just arriving. They've been arriving over the last few days, and they're probably up to about 5,000 in the bay at the moment. We expect them to go higher than that. We're expecting maybe there might be 15,000 to 20,000 optimally.
And is that a good number when we put it in the context of where the numbers have been recently? I know at one point it was far higher than that, but if it does map out to that 15,000 range, would that be a good result?
That would be a good result because the last couple of years the numbers were a little bit lower on the bay, partly as a result of the fact that the horseshoe crabs only spawn when the water temperature is at least 59 degrees. And the last couple of years, those numbers were lower initially, and so that created a little bit of a problem. If there were 15 to 20,000, that would be really great. But it's important to remember that the birds that come through Delaware Bay, some of them stop in South Carolina. So it's a coast-wide population that we're really interested in, even though they've been a little lower in Delaware Bay.
And for those, like, this is new to me. I'm learning about the red knot and the horseshoe crab here. So explain why the horseshoe crab is so important to the red knot in their migration.
The importance of red knot for Delaware Bay and horseshoe crabs to the red knot is that red knots arrive here, they may have arrived from Florida, but they may have also arrived from the northern coast of South America, or they may have arrived from Tierra del Fuego, which is some 7,000 miles away. And so they arrive here, and they really need to build up their weight. They arrive at about 100 grams. And in the 2 or 3 weeks that they're here, they will almost double their weight. And that is possible because of the abundance of horseshoe crab eggs. When they're in Delaware Bay, that is all they eat. And the horseshoe crab eggs are easily digestible. And that's why the draw of Delaware Bay is so important, because we have the horseshoe crabs and the horseshoe crab eggs.
But those numbers of horseshoe crabs have been going down. Why?
They've been going down for a number of reasons. Climate change may be one, but also because they're harvested and used as bait. Not the eggs, but the horseshoe crabs themselves are used as bait for eel and conch and a number of other things. And the crabs were not used for bait before about the 1990s. They were used a little bit by a few of the people who were fishing, but they weren't used as an industry. And so that's part of the problem, is that this is a relatively new industry to the bay. Horseshoe crabs have been around for millions of years, and this use of them for bait is new.
And so there have been regulatory attempts to rein in the horseshoe crab harvest, correct? Can you give us a sketch of what those are and whether they're working?
In New Jersey, there's a moratorium. You can't take horseshoe crabs for bait in New Jersey. And there's also some regulations in the other surrounding states, but there's a question about whether or not that's sufficient to increase the population of the horseshoe crab. The numbers of horseshoe crabs have declined slightly, and that's created a problem. So it's a problem of both management as well as temperatures, because the shorebirds only come through a short period of time. And if the horseshoe crab numbers increase, but the water temperatures are such that they only spawn in June, it doesn't help the red knots.
Yeah.
So it's really important to build up the populations. So if fewer are spawning in, say, May because of water temperatures, there'd still be enough for the red knots.
And we only have about 15 seconds for you to answer this, but why should we all care about the Red Knot?
Well, we should all care about Red Knot because, first of all, Red Knot is iconic of the bay, but it's also a indicator for other species because there are many species of shorebirds, and the four species of shorebirds in the world that are declining the most include those that go through Delaware Bay. Mm. So it's an indication of the health of the bay and the health of the horseshoe crabs.
Well, that's wonderful, and thank you so much for getting us up to speed. That was Joanna Berger, professor of ecology at Rutgers University. Up next, we are talking election results on Studio 2. Stick with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. After countless forums and commercials and dollars spent, we have a winner. The Democratic nominee for mayor of Philadelphia will be former state rep and city council member Sherelle Parker. At last check, Parker had about a third of the primary vote, giving her an 11-point lead over Rebecca Reinhart and Helen Gim, who are very tightly bunched. Alan Dom and Jeff Brown looks like they will finish in fourth and fifth place, respectively.
Yeah, and if history is any guide, Parker will likely become the city's 100th mayor, the first woman and first black woman to hold the office. So what does it all mean and what messages can we take away from other races in our region? We want to hear what you think. Tell us the race that mattered most to you. Are you happy with the outcome? Our number is 888-477-9499 or email us at studio2@whyy.org.
Joining us today to analyze the results, we have two guests. Richardson Dilworth is professor of politics at Drexel University and author of Reforming Philadelphia 1682 to 2022, quite a range. Hello, Richard. Welcome to Studio 2.
I'm glad to be here.
We also have on the line Democratic media consultant Neil Oxman joining us remotely. Hello, Neil.
Hello, Avi. How are you?
I'm well. All right. So let's dive in. Mm-hmm. I'm going to start with you, Richard. Heard a lot that voters wanted change, didn't like the status quo, but it looks like the winner of the Democratic primary will be a longtime politician who had a ton of establishment support in terms of endorsements, union support in terms of endorsements. Reaction. What's your big takeaway here? Yeah. I mean, how did Sherelle Parker pull this off?
Well, in answer to the question of voters wanting change and whether or not this was going to be a change election, any election is going to be a change election, and it's going to maintain some form of a status quo. I think
right.
That's the nature of any election, with some exceptions. The question of sort of the specific mayoral election and whether or not it was change or whether or not it was a sort of maintenance of the status quo, I think is complicated by the fact that mayoral elections are both they're both elections on issues, but more so than any other race in the city, they're also elections on personality. And I think it would be really hard to separate out the idea of change from the current mayor and the sort of perceived public personality of the current mayor from the larger issues. The relative union support, the relative backing of the various groups, it's not clear to me, and I'd love any sense that Neil Oxman has about this, that whether or not that's important in terms of public perception and how voters perceive the candidates, or whether or not it's more important in terms of actually the ground game and getting out the vote, and also of course the money support.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that endorsements of prior mayors and ostensibly popular prior mayors didn't seem to have a tremendous effect certainly suggests that those kind of endorsements aren't important from that perspective.
And I want to bring Neil into the conversation because in my mind, Sherelle Parker ran a very traditional campaign, as Avi mentioned. She created coalitions with the old Democratic Guard, unions, black church leaders, Latino Guard, other elected officials. What does this say to me? I ask you, Neil, what does it say about the power of the Democratic machine in the city to pick mayor?
Well, it is better to have support wherever it comes from than not have the support. This election was really interesting in that it was about nothing. There was no, it was not a referendum. It was not a referendum on anything, as many past mayoral elections have been. It was really about the bases of these five people and their appeal to certain groups of Philadelphians, really with the exception of Jeff Brown, who, I mean, if I told you guys last November 1st that this person you'd never heard of, Jeff Brown, on February 1st, 4 months later, would be in first place in all the polls, the private polls that were leaked, and then 6 weeks later would be in last place, you would think, well, that's nuts.
Yeah.
But with the exception of him, this really was about the different bases in the city, B-A-S-E-S in the city. Mm. And you know, Dom's base was much smaller. 59% of Democratic primary voters in Philadelphia are women. And if you asked women, I would bet that three quarters of the women in this city yesterday voted for one of the three women candidates. They had good choices. What Sherelle had was, A, she ran a very good campaign, but B, the quote progressive wing of the party, whether it was old time ADA liberals, you know, like Richard's grandfather, the old Chestnut Hill liberals who were left and Mount Airy liberals who were left, down to the kids who live in Pennsport, those votes were split yesterday.
Hmm. Well, but before we get there, though, Neil, I would love, because some people who are listening outside the city might need this filled in a bit. You describe this as a battle of the bases, Neil. So who was Sherelle Parker's base? Because clearly that was a strong base.
Right. Sherelle's base were these four large African-American wards in northwest Philadelphia where she really did wonderfully and overperformed. The greater African-American community in the city, which was supplemented by lots of union support, which gave her financial support, and the fact that 52% of registered voters in the city are African-American, 40% are white. And so if you're the only, quote, real African-American candidate in the race, she was. The other African-American candidates were very minor. I mean, Amen Brown and Judge DeLeon. I mean, you know, Sherelle had a long record in the legislature and in city council. She was non-controversial. You know, when John Street ran for mayor in 99 for the first time, he was much more of a controversial figure than Sherelle is. So Sherelle wasn't turning anybody off. Mm-hmm. And because black voters in this city have just a large registration advantage, her base was yesterday, because the progressives were split, was big enough that she was able to end up with a third of the vote, just turning out her base and running much more of a traditional campaign, given the assets she had, both financially and from, quote, traditional, you know, Democratic establishment.
Yeah, and I want to bring, Richard, I want to bring you back in the conversation because I want to expand on that and talk about the progressives. Michael Kor wrote a comment today on Instagram. He was talking about how the most progressive part of the city has a diversity problem. Like, it's very white. They don't have enough black voters in that coalition. Can you comment on that? Because clearly, what Neil said, I mean, it seems like the large chunk of black voters went to a less progressive candidate in Sherelle Parker. Can you talk about progressive? What do they need to do so that, you know, someone like a Helen Gim or a Rebecca Reinhart is more attractive?
What do they need to do? Well, I do think there is a little bit of a referendum in terms of the progressive movement in the city, in terms of this vote outcome. And I think in terms of Gim's, surprisingly, I think less than impressive ultimate vote. It's incredibly hard for me to figure anything out in terms of what the council races told us, other mm-hmm. than the power of incumbency for district and even at-large council members. But trying to suss out what those at-large what those at-large elections meant, it seems like kind of a mess. The one thing I think that I was, I mean, we knew this was going to be some sort of a plurality win. We knew that it was going to be relatively divided. We knew that Sherrill Parker was really the only black candidate that had a serious chance. The thing I think, and so we see that. I mean, all of the groups that the Inquirer very elegantly sort of divided up really mm-hmm. sort of did what we would expect them to do, and we knew that was going to happen. I think what we didn't know was the specific margins, and in this kind of a 3-4-5-way race, we didn't know, you know, those margins were going to be incredibly significant. I think given the margin that Sherrill Parker ultimately had, it ended up not being as significant, and the margins didn't matter that much. If I'm right, and I think I'm right, the percent total black vote for Sherrill Parker wasn't as overwhelming as we might have expected, mm-hmm. given that. And it's not fair to, I think, as Neil Oxman just pointed out, it's not fair to compare this to Katz versus Street. But at the same time, and I think I'm getting these numbers right. Like it was lower than 90%.
So I want to follow up though on this thread of what this means for progressive candidates. Mm-hmm. We have a tweet from Jillian who says Helen Gim ran a national campaign for a local election and that hurt her. She did bring in a lot of big national endorsements and star power, Bernie Sanders, AOC, mm-hmm. I believe Mark Ruffalo tweeted uh-huh. about her.
National press.
Other progressive candidates have gotten national press before and performed well. Larry Krasner won a citywide election, getting a ton of national attention and progressive endorsements. Is it, Neil, I'll ask you, is it just that the mayor's race is different by nature, or is it perhaps the case that this is a different field?
That was irrelevant. I mean, in the sense that it didn't turn anybody off. Helen lost this race in 2022. 4 years ago, one of the most interesting things about this race is 4 years ago, Helen got over 100,000 votes running for re-election to city council. Mm-hmm. Yesterday, she got fewer than half of that. And the reason is she waited forever to run for mayor. I've done every mayor's race but one since 1979. And I was a kid in 71 and 5, knocked on doors against Frank Rizzo. And so I've been involved in a lot of them. And what she did was she waited too long. And because she waited too long, she invited another liberal like her, not quite as progressive, but still another liberal into the race.
Rebecca Reinhart, you mean?
In Rebecca Reinhart. And if you look at the vote results, what you will see is that among 40-year-old plus voters and where they lived who are, quote, liberal, Rebecca won those divisions and those wards, and Gim won the ones under 40. If Reinhart had not been in the race, this dynamic would have been very, very different. Now, I'm not saying Sherrill would still, you know, not have won. You know, she clearly might have won. She ended up with, you know,
double digit,
60% of the black vote. I mean, that's, you know, what I can figure. Actually, interestingly, Jeff Brown ended up with the second highest total of African-American votes by far. Wasn't even close.
So, what, Neil, are you saying, though, this is not a referendum on progressive policies much as strategy specific to Gim?
No. I mean, part of it is Gim's personality. It's not necessarily on. Look, all these candidates in the race were liberal. I mean, you know, Alan Dom is liberal. This is not, you know, some right-wing Marjorie Taylor Greene kook bag in a primary. You know, it's liberal versus more liberal. And the fact is that if there'd only been one liberal in the race, one liberal female in the race, as qualified as Reinhart and as Gim were, and that there were only one of them, this might have been a different outcome, yeah. But it certainly would have been much closer than it ended up being.
Yeah, if you're just tuning in, we have Neil Oxman, a political consultant working here in Pennsylvania. We also have Richard Dilworth, Drexel University professor of politics and the author of Reforming Philadelphia. We're talking elections. We're talking about the aftermath of primary day. You can call us, give us your thoughts, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. I also want to throw in here, Richard, a question. Sherelle Parker, she won far less than 100,000 votes, it looks like. She'll have not a majority or a mandate, really. Does it matter? Will this low-level vote win affect her at all when she tries to lead, assuming she wins the general?
No, I don't think it will. Huh. And I want to address that, and then I want to actually return back to the question of national issues versus local issues, if I can.
Sure.
I think what Neil, if I may call you Neil, I think what you pointed out was right, that the bandwidth for these candidates was. The ideological bandwidth for these candidates was so small that they're competing in a primary, things become to sort of warped funhouse mirror of how we conceive of them in terms of some sort of liberal conservative continuum. But they're all liberal.
Yeah.
The overall consensus in which they're operating means that I think there's ultimately not a tremendous difference between them. So I think that really reduces the concern about somebody winning the primary with less than 50%. The other important thing is that it's entirely typical for primary candidates in Philadelphia running for mayor to not win a majority of the vote.
We see this quite a
bit. But this isn't just not a majority. We're talking about, less than I think she was hovering at 70,000. Yeah, a third, but about 70,000 votes. We're talking low turnout as well. So, Neil,
Sherry, I did Michael Nutter's campaign. He got 37% and governed fairly effectively. John Street easily won, not easily, but won in two general elections, getting less than 50% of the vote in his first primary. The Democratic base coalesces around the candidate for mayor. Sherelle Parker is going to get somewhere between 65% and 80% of the vote in the general election. And right now, everybody, including the press, perceives her as the next mayor. And she's going to have the power of the mayor's office. And she's, she has enough relationships on city council that if she has any sense, she's starting to put a serious administration together right now.
Richard, you wanted also to talk a little bit more about that national local divide and how it plays out in these types of elections. Do you want to expand on that?
I do think that a relatively new phenomenon in terms of the relationship between national politics and local politics in Philadelphia is if we went back further several decades, I think what we would see is that Philadelphia tended, that political change in Philadelphia tended to follow national realignments. And certainly you see some element of that. But I think a relatively new phenomenon is that a specific candidate who runs in the Democratic primary for president energizes a specific base, and that specific base builds up some sort of organizational strength that continues on to affect local elections even after that candidate's gone.
Mm.
And I think that that's a phenomenon that really starts in 2004 with Howard Dean, and I think you saw it especially pronounced in 2016 with Bernie Sanders, resulting in him coming to Philadelphia to support Helen Gim. That's, I think, a relatively new phenomenon, and it speaks to the fragmentation of the Democratic Party nationally and locally in a way that I think is at least since the 21st century, a relatively new phenomenon in party politics.
Can I ask a quick question to you, Richard, about money? Because Alan Dom, there was a lot of money raised in this race overall. Alan Dom spent the most. Jeff Brown was clearly second. They are going to finish well behind sort of the three contenders, who ended up being the three contenders. So is that just a commentary on their candidacies, or is it a commentary on the limits of money to sway a local race like this?
I personally think it's a commentary on the relative limits of spending a lot of money to sway a local race, and certainly Tom Knox prior to that speaks to that as well. Jeff Brown can arguably sort of be the closest analogy to Tom Knox in this current
And Tom Knox was a business person as well, and spent a lot of money and was not successful.
Right. Yeah.
So just another lesson there, I suppose.
Yeah. And then of course the organizational support, the independent spending for the candidates, and the ability to have the organizational power for a ground game is significant as well.
Yeah. And I want to shift, because we have a lot of other, you know, things we want to talk about today, and I want to shift and talk about city council a bit, because we have, you know, a huge sort of turnover in city council. We have, you know, a number of new candidates. We even have challenges, like we talked about the 8th district race that we touched on. We talk about incumbencies here in Philadelphia. Doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be able to keep your spot like you may have been able to do in years past. Neil, I want you to comment a little bit about sort of like the changing of the guard here in Philly and how City Hall will be affected overall.
Well, that's a great question. The answer is, I don't think quite as much in terms of the membership. I think the bigger question is, who's going to be the council president? Mm. And how is that person going to run city council the same or differently than the current council president, who's really run the council like a kingdom and his fiefdom, and really not a lot gets done unless he says this is going to happen. And so, you know, there were all kinds of deals made with ward leaders and with candidates for city council about who they're going to support for the next, you know. Effectively, yesterday was not only an election for city council, where people were running for months for council. It was also an election for who the next council president is going to be. And a lot of people were supported by the organization or ward leaders or clumps of ward leaders or Philly 3.0 or the Working Families Party people, simply because those council candidates quietly pledged their support to one or the other people who are running for council president right now.
Yeah. And the two major contenders, I understand, Daryl Clark is the current council president, but he's, you know, decided not to run again in the 5th district. But we have Kenyatta Johnson out of the 2nd district, Curtis Jones as well. Those were the ones. It's unclear. I don't know, unless you have can glean into the crystal ball. Who do you think will be the next CP?
Yeah, I don't know. And, you know, Mark Squilla thinks he's, you know, is sort of touting himself as if those two are deadlocked as a compromise. You know, it's Byzantine, 12th century papal politics.
That does sound kind of intriguing, though. We have about a minute left, Neil. Before we end, I did want to get your thoughts on that state house race that took place in Delaware County that could have impacted control of the state house. Comment from Herb, who said, "I am happy Heather Boyd, who is the Democrat, won. Abortion was on the ballot." Do you think a national issue, and of course a local issue as well, like abortion, was the deciding factor in that race, why the Democrats got over the hump there? Why do you think the Democrats were able to hold that seat and ultimately hold control of the House?
Well, that was part of it. The seat, which used to be Republican, the Democrats didn't take it over till 2018, is becoming more Democratic. But the bigger stakes, of course, were the fact that the legislature was 101 to 101. And the Democrats right now, because we have a sitting governor, you know, was able to, the Democrats were able to raise a lot more money than Republicans and run a much, you know, and vastly outspend the Republican nominee because the stakes were so high. If the legislature were 110 to, you know, to 93, that wouldn't have mattered.
Interesting. Well, that's the end of this conversation. Of course, we have much more politics conversation to come in the months ahead. Richardson Dilworth is a professor of politics at Drexel University and author of Reforming Philadelphia 1682 to 2022. Thanks for being with us. And Neil Oxman is a Democratic media consultant. You're listening to Studio 2.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
So most people know of Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass, but what about the story of Ellen and William Craft, their daring escape from enslavement and their abolitionist efforts? Ever heard of that?
You know, I love history, Cherry. I had never heard of this story.
Well, it's an incredible story, Avi. The couple hatched a brilliant and dangerous plan to escape, which involved Ellen Craft, a light-skinned black woman who disguised herself as a wealthy white man traveling north for medical treatment, with her husband, William, posing as her enslaved valet. They journeyed thousands of miles, including their stop in Philadelphia. They pursued the entire time by by slave catchers under the Fugitive Slave Clause.
And now writer Ilyan Wu has written a historical novel about the Crafts called Master Slave Husband Wife. It is getting rave reviews, and our own Mary Cummings Jordan recently spoke with the author about bringing this overlooked story to the page.
Ilyan Wu, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
So who were Ellen and William Craft, and how did they meet?
So Ellen and William Craft were an enslaved couple from Macon, Georgia. She was a skilled dressmaker, enslaved by her biological half-sister. And he was a cabinet maker and artisan. So they're both urban enslaved people. And they met, we're not actually sure exactly where they met, but notes kept by descendants suggest that they met around 1846.
They had in common the agony of forced family separation, a hallmark of enslavement in the American South. Ellen was torn away from her mother. William loses his sister, Eliza, to the auction block. And Ilyan, you write, the selling of his sister inflamed a terrible rage. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, it was a devastating turning point in the life of this child to see his last remaining family member sold away from him. I mean, this had started with seeing his parents sold one by one before he was 10 years old. And then he saw his brothers and sisters, older than him, presumably, sold before him. And then last left was the sister. And in this moment of, you know, final separation, once they're separated, there's, you know, they may never, ever see each other again. And that one chance to say goodbye that he pleads for, you know, is denied. And it just, it's really a central moment, I think, that launches him on his eventual escape to freedom.
Yeah. So Ellen and William decide to make that bid for freedom. Tell us about the plan and their costumes.
Yes. I mean, this was just an ingenious disguise. And it came together. The thing that's so remarkable about it is that it came together so fast. They said they actually took 4 days to plan and figure this all out. I mean, of course, they'd been preparing, thinking about it for a lifetime, but it all came together very, very fast. And what happened was Ellen needed to pass as a rich, white male enslaver. I mean, completely opposite from the role that she regularly plays in life, right? And in order to get the pieces of this disguise, it was William who would go to different shops around Macon, a different shop for each item, so as not to rouse any suspicion. So he gathers these things up. She happens to have, and this is pretty key, a separate workspace behind the master's house. And in that locked space, she actually has a cabinet that he's made for her, or a set of drawers. And so she hides these items one by one until it's the big day.
So they needed to begin their journey separately. One part of the journey involved time spent aboard a steamship, and Ellen, in the guise of a man, of course, was forced to spend time in the company of other men, which surely must have been incredibly uncomfortable.
Oh, my goodness, yes. I mean, again, they push it to the very last minute. There's a last bell that comes on. And then, you know, one of the things that I learned is that this particular steamship that she rode was an extremely claustrophobic space. It's not like one of those big sort of wedding cake-shaped steamships that we often think about. It's very, very close. Quarters are very tight. They're gendered. So she's in this gentleman's saloon, surrounded by men. One guy with a gold watch is already peering intently at her as soon as she walks in. She's going to have to eat beside these men. She's going to need to sleep in a berth beside these men. It's going to be extremely closely watched.
Yeah, unbelievable. So they're heading north. Philadelphia is part of the route, just across the Mason-Dixon line.
Yes.
The crafts do eventually reach Philadelphia, ostensibly a free city and a free state, perhaps not as free as it should have been. What was their emotion? What were they feeling? Do we know, Ilyan?
I mean, I think they are exhilarated. They fall to their knees in prayer and giving thanks the moment they arrive. They are also absolutely exhausted. I mean, they spent 4 sleepless nights in preparation and then 4 almost completely sleepless nights traveling on the road. At least for Ellen, she didn't sleep at all. There was a dangerous moment where William did fall asleep, but that's a separate story. And when they get to Philadelphia, you know, they want to be able to pause and rest. And that's why that one of the first things they ask is, are we safe here? But the answer, of course, is no. Yeah. They have to move on.
Well, and just briefly, a couple more moments on Philadelphia. It was a center for anti-slavery activism, but you also write that at the time, refugees were flooding into the city, not only from the South, but from abroad, that nativism and anti-immigrant sentiment bubbled hot, exploding into riots, and the city's black population was a target.
Exactly. So, I mean, we think of Philadelphia as being sort of this final destination, and it did have a great abolitionist movement that was especially, you know, getting to the point where it was going to launch at this moment. But, you know, William Still, father of the Underground Railroad, he was just starting out at this time. Some of the biggest leaders, like Robert Purvis and his wife Harriet, they actually had to leave the city because things got so bad.
So en route to Boston, the Crafts encounter a charismatic man, William Wells Brown, himself formerly enslaved, who urges them to take their story to the abolitionist lecture circuit. They agree. And as you write, Ilyan, it was a new perilous journey. What was the danger?
They are absolutely in danger. I mean, the safest thing for them to do would have been to settle down, change their names, go to Canada, which was their original plan. But you are right. Absolutely. This self-emancipated, best-selling author, lecturer, performer, really, William Wells Brown, he was a great storyteller. He was also a great marketer as an abolitionist activist. And he knows as soon as he hears about this story that this one is really going to move people. And the problem for the Crafts, of course, and for William Wells Brown himself, too, is that they are extremely vulnerable to seizure, to capture at any point on the road, especially since they decide not to change their names. But when he invites them, when he says, you can move people with your story, please join me, they do this incredibly brave thing and they say yes. And so they end up traveling yet another 1,000 miles, more than 1,000 miles, all over New England, telling and sharing their story.
It's an extraordinary story. Why is it not better known?
Well, as one of the Crafts' descendants has shared frequently with me, whether people know the story depends on who they are and where they're coming from. That said, the Kraft story doesn't have sort of the name recognition that many others do. They've been studied in academia. The family has known their story, and some have cherished and followed the story for years. But as far as the broader recognition, I think this is a story that is so complicated. I mean, it doesn't have a neat ending in Philadelphia. It doesn't have a single sort of moment that we can celebrate. Yeah. And it challenges us on so many levels. And I think those difficulties are part of why why the story is so resonant and so particularly ready to be reread and studied now.
Yeah. How would you characterize the Kraft's place in American history?
They are absolutely American heroes. I mean, you can trace the history of America through their family from the very beginning all the way up to the present day. If you start with the fact that Ellen's paternal grandfather, a white man, was fighting in the Revolution. And then if you think about the fact that her great-great-granddaughter was a freedom writer and a community activist, oral historian, poet, to now, this line of the Crafts reaches from 1776 all the way to the present day.
Ilyanwu, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me today.
That was Mary Cummings Jordan talking with Ilyanwu, author of the new novel, Master, Slave, Husband, Wife. Pretty good discussion there.
Yeah, fascinating stuff.
Fascinating. Well, that is it for us today. For more of our show, head on over to WHYY.org/studio2 and follow WHYY on Twitter. We use the hashtag Studio2.
Our producers are Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Our engineer is Al Banks. Thanks, Al. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Thank you so much for joining us today.